So if you imagine life for the average Russian working woman or peasant woman in towards the end of the 19th century, it's really not a very pleasant mental exercise. The great majority of Russian women lived in abject poverty, whether in the countryside or in the emerging manufacturing centres of Moscow and Petersburg and other cities. Long traditions of female subservience and inferiority, which most people really internalised, exacerbated all the worst aspects of women's lives. As women migrated to find work in the cities, they got the lowest paid jobs and suffered from the most degrading aspects of industrialisation. Bosses and managers exploited women as underpaid workers and as sex objects. Women had no social support during pregnancy, no childcare, no access to contraception or to abortion. And it goes without saying that they had the double burden of paid work in the factories and unpaid work at home. And yet, out of this morass of poverty, inequality and oppression, in October 1917, when the working class took power in Russia, out of this came the most progressive advances towards women's liberation that have been seen since the division of society into classes. And today, in Australia in 2011, we still don't have the rights that women won in October 1917. So I hope to reveal over the course of this discussion why it was that the workers' movement, involving the mass of working women and men, managed to achieve what it did. I want to uncover the role of bourgeois feminism, that is, the movement of ruling class women to gain equal rights within the framework of capitalism. What was the feminists' role in the women's movement? How do they interact with working women? And what does this tell us about how we need to organise for women's liberation today? Before the first Russian Revolution of 1905, there really was no women's movement, so to speak, although there were groups of feminists in Russia. Mainly, these were women of the aristocracy, and these groups focused on sort of respectable charity work. They campaigned for women's education, they moralised against prostitution, and they read and wrote literature about, as it was then known, the woman question. And the bourgeois feminists and the suffrage movement that emerged after 1905 inherited some of their ideas. Working women, on the other hand, came to the woman question in quite a different way, and that was through their participation in the labour movement. From the 1870s onwards, women began to cut their teeth in strikes and protests for better wages and living standards. The Russian Marxist Alexandra Kollontai wrote of this period, "The movement of women workers is, by its very nature, an indivisible part of the general workers' movement. In all the risings and in all the factory riots which were so distasteful to Tsarism, the working woman took an equal part alongside the working man." Kollontai characterises this movement, the pre-1905 movement, as economistic, which really means that women at this point did not connect what they were doing with any well-developed ideas about sexual oppression. And this all changed in 1905, the year of revolution. Women participated in every aspect of this revolt, starting with the march to the Winter Palace on the 9th of January, which marched to present a petition to the Tsar for workers' rights. And Nicholas II's personal guard opened fire and massacred peaceful demonstrators in the Bloody Sunday massacre, sparking the unsuccessful 1905 uprising. And this event prompted a massive politicisation throughout the whole of Russian society, including working women, who started to organise, to discuss political ideas and to become conscious of their own oppression as women. Strike demands in any workplace that employed women began to emphasise things like paid maternity leave, getting time off to feed infants and demands for nurseries to be built in the factories in which they worked. Now, before 1905, it had been quite difficult to organise working women, and they were underrepresented in every measure of political life. While women made up at various points between a third and a half of the workforce, they were always a tiny minority of trade unionists and a tiny minority of membership of political parties, including the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. This was because women had very little control over their lives. They had no access to, as we said, no access to contraception or any safe forms of abortion. And the domestic duties that they had to perform, combined with paid work, resulted in them having very little time for anything else at all. Their literacy rate was even lower than that of working men. And women's low pay also had an impact on their ability to be political, because it made it difficult to pay union dues, for example, and it left women exhausted and starving. Factory owners and bosses had worked out how to use internalised sexism and women's lack of confidence to boost their own profits. According to one factory inspector, the boss preferred to hire women because of their greater industry, attentiveness and abstinence, they do not smoke or drink, their compliance and greater reasonableness in respect to pay. So this greater reasonableness in respect to pay meant that women were forced to work for children's wages or for two-thirds of what an employer would have to pay a man. Alexander Kollontai said of the Russian working woman that her shoulders were bent under the weight of an unbearable oppression. During the flurry of politicisation that developed out of workers' self-activity in 1905, people started to break out of this malaise. And I think Kollontai really understood the dynamic when she wrote, "At a time of unrest and strike action, the proletarian woman, downtrodden, timid and without rights, suddenly grows and learns to stand tall and straight. The self-centred, narrow-minded and politically backward female becomes an equal, a fighter and a comrade. Participation in the workers' movement brings the woman worker towards her liberation, not only as the seller of her labour power, but also as a woman, a wife, a mother and a housekeeper." So in essence, fighting back changes people, it develops their ideas, and it changes how they think about themselves. The revolutionary movement of workers pulled other sections of society in to this debate and political ferment. And in 1905, the bourgeois feminist movement founded a number of its own organisations, to which they strove to recruit working women throughout 1905 and in the coming years, between 1905 and the outbreak of World War I. The basic aim of bourgeois feminism is to integrate women of the ruling class in running capitalism alongside men of this class. So the feminists stood for women's suffrage and for various liberal reforms, but they definitely did not support revolution, and they did not support many demands that working class women instinctively made. For example, at the first organisational Congress of the Women's Equal Rights Union, a number of working class women put forward a motion that included demands for equal pay and welfare for mothers and children. The feminists rejected this because by ruling class reasoning, whether you're male or female, equal pay simply means spending more money on labour power. And it's also quite obvious that this class wants to avoid wasting money on really unnecessary things like social welfare and looking after the unproductive poor. So already the class lines were starting to be drawn. However, at this point, working women had not sufficiently developed their own class consciousness in such a way that would allow them to reject wholesale the bourgeois feminist organisations. Because women were politically less experienced than men, they were a bit more susceptible to the feminists' attempts at class collaboration. And I guess by contrast, if you think of the cadets, a mainstream bourgeois party, this organisation had virtually no appeal for working men. So the Bolsheviks, when they started to organise among working women, came up against the bourgeois feminists, who had set up political clubs specifically to appeal to working class women, to try to draw them in. And for a while, the feminists were quite successful in recruiting them and in attracting ordinary women to their meetings and so on. But the incompatibility of their class interests very quickly became apparent. Women domestic servants, for example, started to organise meetings among themselves, sometimes while still belonging to the same feminist organisations as their employers. In one case, a bourgeois woman named Ispolatieva, who was on the leadership of the Women's Equal Rights Union, reported that her cook was organising servants' meetings in her kitchen. So Ispolatieva went along to keep an eye on things and, to show these women how it should be done. And when the servants' meetings got too large to fit in the kitchen, they were moved to the staircase of the servants' entrance, but always confined to the servants' quarters. So I think this illustrates the unease of relations between exploiter and exploited. Even when sometimes our bosses try to tell us that we're all sisters or that we're all on the same side because we're women. Actually, the women of the ruling class are never going to consider us to be their equals. And as well, the servants continually overstepped the boundaries of what was acceptable to their bourgeois mistresses. They formed trade unions and held strikes. Their demands included the 8-hour day, a minimum wage, and emphasised their need to be treated like human beings. Normally, a domestic maid would just be given a corner to sleep in, so they wanted their own rooms and some respect. And their class interests pitted them directly against their employers. And needless to say, the bourgeois ladies were very disappointed in these ungrateful rabble. Socialist organisers also responded, thanks, to the radicalising layer of women in this period, in 1905 and after. A core of the leadership of the Bolshevik Party, including Lenin and Krupskaya, saw that there was a real need to relate to working women as women, to talk to them about sexism and about workers' rights, how these things intersect and what to do about them. And for this reason, the Bolsheviks formed special organising bodies that could relate to working women. They produced newspapers and held meetings about working women's issues. They pointed out that the bourgeois feminists had no solutions for the most pressing issues for working women, and that the interests of exploiter and exploited were totally counterposed. That while women of the ruling class wanted to keep capitalism going and were happy just to get the vote and be able to participate in exploitation, particularly of their maids and of underpaid women workers, working women, on the other hand, had to overthrow the whole system if they wanted freedom and equality, the right not to starve and all these things. So this meant that working class women had to separate themselves from the feminists organisationally as well as in their political beliefs, and completely reject the unity that the feminists wanted. And the same arguments came up at a conference in 1908, which involved both feminists and numbers of working class women. The class lines emerged very clearly, particularly as the conference ended with a banquet that workers could not afford to attend. During the banquet, a Bolshevik woman stood up and loudly said, "Why aren't there working women, peasant women and maids at this table?" And over the course of this conference, the socialists made constant appeals for disunity. Because really, when you think about it, what does it mean for all women to be united? What does it mean for maids to unite with their mistresses or workers with their bosses? The ruling class have control over society. They have absolutely no reason to compromise. They have no reason to relinquish their ability to reap the benefits of exploiting working women. So in any cross-class alliance, it's always the workers who compromise their demands, not the other way around. And so the revolutionaries argued for a clean break with bourgeois feminism. And a lot of the time it was not easy going. Alexandra Kollontai became known as that horrible Kollontai. She was accused of hooliganism, and one feminist shouted at her, "Strangling's too good for you." So she must have known she was doing something right. These debates raged on in the years leading up to World War I. The scales tipped in favour of the revolutionary socialists. Kollontai drew in working-class women to her hooligan activities. Domestic servants, workers in cardboard, rubber, tobacco and footwear industries attended feminist meetings with her to heckle their leadership. As the class struggle developed, women workers organised large-scale and militant strikes. And the feminists were no longer game to attend the meetings that they called. Often, during this period, women would spark off a strike and call on male workers to join them. Out of this movement, many women became bold enough to demand an end to the sexist treatment that they suffered by factory foremen and supervisors. They had suffered all kinds of horrible working conditions under industrialisation, but sometimes the thing that could spark off a strike might be the foreman swearing at them or using disrespectful language. From 1913 onwards, working women celebrated International Women's Day amid police repression and harassment. Speakers and demonstrators were arrested, their meetings were broken up, and in order to even get their events to happen, they had to use all sorts of tricks and diversions. For example, one year they held the event 6 days earlier than the police expected, and so on. This conflict between working women and the state reflected a general social crisis and an increasingly revolutionary and militant working class. But the outbreak of World War I was a temporary swing back the other way. The war broke out with a wave of patriotism, and it was at first enormously popular. There were demonstrations in the street in support of it. Leon Trotsky identified the reason for this. He wrote, "The people whose lives day in and day out pass in a monotony of hopelessness are many. The alarm of mobilisation breaks into their lives like a promise. The familiar and long-hated is overthrown, and the new and unusual reigns in its place. Changes still more incredible are in store for them in the future, for better or for worse. For the better, of course. What can seem worse than normal conditions?" The Bolsheviks opposed World War I right from the start, but they were isolated in doing so. Bourgeois feminists, many of whom had identified as pacifists before the war, actually rallied behind the war effort and strove to organise working women in support of it. And their sentiments can be summed up by a statement from the League for Women's Equality. "We women have to unite, and each of us, forgetting personal misfortune and suffering, must devote all our energy, intellect and knowledge to our country. This is our obligation to the fatherland, and this will give us the right to participate as the equals of men in the new life of victorious Russia." So whether or not they genuinely thought they were going to get rights out of this, who knows? But ultimately, the feminists proved themselves to be on the side of those who rule. They were for a stable system because they wanted to participate in running that system. Contrast this to the response of the Russian Bolsheviks. Because of their traditions, their political clarity, and their level of organisation, they were able to stand against the patriotic fervour. The party rank and file began immediately to agitate against the war, drawing the Bolshevik Duma faction to oppose it too. As part of their anti-war organising, Bolshevik agitators made a direct appeal to working women. They called meetings in 1915 and 1916 to celebrate International Women's Day and to oppose the war. This was treason, and there was a government ban on organising, so they had to have flash meetings that assembled and dispersed very quickly, but they did manage to hold meetings. In 1916, a group of Bolshevik students posted up this proclamation from the Petrograd Committee of the party. "Comrades, working women, this is the day of our solidarity, the day when the working woman, breaking her ancient bonds of submission, slavery and humiliation, proudly joins the ranks of the international proletariat for the struggle with the common enemy, capital. Working women, let us roar in the face of insatiable capital. Enough blood, down with the war, bring the criminal autocracy to justice."
Yeah.
And gradually, the sheer horror of war shifted public opinion against it in the most brutal way possible. 2.5 million Russians were killed, and by 1917, there was an absolute economic crisis. There was no food in the shops, and people were starving. A police report in January 1917 described the mood among working-class women. "The mothers of families, exhausted from endless standing in line at the stores, tormented by the look of their half-starving and sick children, are very likely closer now to revolution than members of the Duma. And of course, they are more dangerous because they represent that store of inflammable material for which one spark will set off a fire." And how accurate this was, really. The February uprising began on International Women's Day in 1917. Tens of thousands of angry working-class women struck, joined by housewives. They rioted, demanding bread, and they looted shops and wrecked tram cars. They then marched through the streets visiting workplaces to bring out the better organised and more experienced male workers to join them in their protests. Those who characterise the role of women in February as completely unorganised forget that this day had been for several years, a day on which the most political women attended meetings, debated out questions of socialism, of revolution, and women's oppression, and tried to organise in whatever ways they could. This is a popular story about how striking women mobilised working men from a nearby factory. On the morning of February the 23rd, one could hear women's voices in the lane. Down with the war, down with hunger, bread for the workers. Myself and several comrades were at the windows in a flash. The gates were wide open. Masses of women workers filled the lane and their mood was militant. Those who caught sight of us began to wave their arms, shouting, "Come out, quit work." Snowballs flew through the window. We decided to join the demonstration. These women who organised this were not the most raw, inexperienced people off the street. They had organised strikes during the war, which meant that they were fairly politically hard and that they knew who to appeal to, where to go to get support. Some of them had met up with a group of Bolsheviks the day before, talking about the meaning of International Women's Day, a topic about which they clearly had a fair bit to say. The February Revolution was a result of war, crisis, instinctive rage, and leadership. Most historical accounts of the revolution emphasise women's role in the February uprising. And it's true that they played a vital part in this, but it was when the working class took state power in October that things really started to change and that a way forward could be seen for women to be liberated. After the working class took power, women instantly gained full political rights, the right to vote and to hold office, and Soviet Russia became the only country in the world with full freedom of divorce. There was no difference between the status of children born inside or outside of wedlock. When a couple got married, they could choose which partner's name to take or they could choose to combine their names. Women had full and equal employment rights and paid maternity leave. Equal pay became law, whereas after the February uprising, there had still been officially different rates for male work and female work. After October, this was completely equal. Adultery and homosexuality were dropped from the criminal code, and consensual sex became nobody's business but the people involved. In 1919, Lenin said, "In the course of 2 years of Soviet power, in one of the most backward countries in Europe, more had been done to emancipate woman, to make her the equal of the so-called strong sex, than has been done during the past 130 years by all the advanced, enlightened, democratic republics of the world taken together." But the deeply impressed inequalities of Tsarism and capitalism could not be fixed overnight. There were real factors preventing women from being engaged in politics to the same degree as men. Namely, the structures of the family unit still remained. And in Lenin's words, "Notwithstanding all the laws emancipating woman, she continues to be a domestic slave because petty housework crushes, strangles, stultifies and degrades her, chains her to the kitchen and the nursery, and she wastes her labour on barbarously unproductive, petty, nerve-wracking, stultifying and crushing drudgery. The real emancipation of women, real communism, will begin only where and when an all-out struggle begins, led by the proletariat wielding state power against this petty housekeeping, or rather when its wholesale transformation into a large-scale socialist economy begins." Those two sentences might be my favourite Lenin quote of all time. I think it's well worth reading Lenin because I cannot do justice to his characteristic abuse of italics just by reading that passage. And so thus began the Bolsheviks' war on housework. To build a new society, everyone had to be involved. They had to fight on two fronts. One, the material conditions that Lenin was ranting about, and two, they had to draw women into political and cultural life. And those two things were the reason for setting up the Jeunetel, or the Women's Department. The Jeunetel set up childcare centres, communal laundries and restaurants, as well as community housing. And in conditions of civil war that the workers had to confront, I think these efforts are nothing short of heroic. Alexandra Kollontai gives some estimates that in Petrograd between 1919 and 1920, 90% of people were fed by the communal restaurants. And in 1920, 40% of housing was socialised or communal. And I think these attempts at, these attempts at socialisation extended also into the countryside. And gradually people who had to that point lived very traditional lives, very conservative family values and so on, began to trust these aspects of the workers' state. The second goal of the Jeunesse was the politicisation of women. We've seen how women's lack of political education made them less accustomed to debate. And for this reason, women workers often still elected men to represent them. So the Bolsheviks practiced a policy similar to affirmative action or positive discrimination, whereby they set up delegate systems where women could be trained in jobs like running factories or hospitals, serving in the Soviets and trade unions, and working as judges and administrators. All of these things aim to politicise women and to draw them into public life as much as possible. We know how the story ends, so I need to talk about what crushed these measures. Why were the workers ultimately not successful in building a society in which women were liberated? And I think the key thing is that the defeat of the liberatory project for women was bound up in the defeat of the workers' state and ultimately of the revolution itself. A complete explanation for this is beyond the scope of this talk. But to say very briefly, the Russia that emerged from the war and then civil war was a pretty desperate place. The economy was torn to shreds. All the measures that the Jeunesse had to take required the resources of an industrialised economy to implement. And the only way the revolution could have survived was with international revolution elsewhere in Europe that could provide support. And that assistance tragically never arrived. So when the workers' state was defeated, this had a devastating impact on the lives of women. Trotsky wrote years later, "It proved impossible to take the old family by storm, not because the will was lacking and not because the family was so firmly rooted in men's hearts. On the contrary, after a short period of distrust of the government and its creches, kindergartens and like institutions, working women, as well, and after them the more advanced peasants, appreciated the immeasurable advantages of the collective care of children as well as socialisation of the whole family economy. Unfortunately, society proved too poor and too little cultured. The real resources of the state did not correspond to the plans and intentions of the Communist Party. You cannot abolish the family, you have to replace it. The actual liberation of women is unrealisable on the basis of generalised want." Experience soon proved this austere truth, which Marx had formulated 80 years before. But to return to some of the earlier themes, though, the vital point here is that the advances towards liberation that women made were a product of working class revolution. Popular anti-Bolshevik thought suggests that February was the beginning and the end of women's involvement in the Russian Revolution. This is simply not the case. Women were intimately involved with every aspect of the revolution, and through revolution began to discover new capabilities and new capacities. The accounts of courageous resistance by women workers should inspire us, and the Russian Revolution abounds with these anecdotes. Because with the mass participation of the working class in self-government, people begin to demand dignity and respect. Women workers during the intense weeks and months of revolution paid special attention to ridding their workplaces of sexist managers. After setting up a workers' council, this is often the first thing they would do. They would cart off the ones that sexually abused them in wheelbarrows and dump them in the river. And I think this is relevant for today. It really, it shows us the way. This is the kind of story that I want to tell to Christy Fraser-Kirk. You know, because at some point, these managers like Mark McGuinness, who treat women employees as their personal sex objects, and look back with longing on the days when all these women did is try to take them through the courts and get $37 million instead of expropriating them of everything they own and throwing them in the Yarra.
Yeah.
So the deepest changes that were made were the ones that cut right to the heart of exploitation and the way sexism is structured into society, as the working class took things into their own hands. As Lenin put it, every cook must learn to run the state. We've talked all weekend about the revolutionary movements developing as we speak. Women are one half of all of these movements. And today, from Tahrir Square to Wisconsin to Cecilia Judge in our own equal pay campaign. Women workers show the way.